G'day, Money Miners. 25th of May, Thursday, and we're feeling good today. My colleague here, Travis Ricciardo, and I have a little chat in the bag already recorded from Tuesday night.
Mate, it's good Travis. When we don't have to do work.
It is good. We're hopefully we'll get to the stage of doing no work at some point, but I don't think that's feasible. But we had a chat with Richard Morrow from the Lowell Resource Fund. Pronounced correctly in the intro.
I didn't pronounce it. Yeah. I'm proud of you.
Cheers, mate. Now, Lowell are based in Victoria. So they're a resource fund. They like to, we go through their investment strategy. They like to get in the early cycle of the Lassonde curve. And Richard actually got in touch with us because of our Lassonde curve logo. So their big investments are, they're in Musgrave, they're in Predictive, they're in Caravelle, they're in Azure. They were recently in Genesis. They exited that position last month. They like to get into these companies early and backing. I guess what we took away from the chat, Trav, was their investment philosophy is really backing the projects and the people that they think that can deliver these mines to production.
So, mate, the big ones to tick off when you're getting early stage, it's high risk, high reward.
And another good thing we got out of the chat was that we wanted to ask Richard was about mining in Victoria. So as we many people might hear over here that permitting it is a bit more difficult in Victoria, we wanted to know if that's actually the case, what mining is like in Victoria. So Richard, being at the on the ground floor over there, gave us a pretty good insight of what it's like over there. And we had another good Trav had to nick off halfway through. So Richard and I had a good chat about the upcoming copper landscape, because they're heavily invested in copper.
I hear the best questions got asked after I left the chat, man.
no worries. I was left unsupervised. Righto. So without further ado, let's get into our chat with Richard Morrow from the Lowell Resource Fund. Here we go. Richard Morrow from Lowell Resource Fund. Have I pronounced that right, Richard?
Oh, you're pretty close there, Matt.
Yeah. Mate, I don't want people to be barking up the wrong tree to tip a bit of money in. So
he usually gets the project name wrong, so don't take any offence to it, mate. Well,
especially when they're bloody Swedish and shit.
I've been following the podcast and everything. I know his mouth runs away with him sometimes.
Very good, mate. Richard, thanks very much for reaching out, mate, and coming on. And mate, welcome. How is things in Victoria? Is it sunny or miserable and cloudy like usual?
Not too bad, really. Although we are heading into winter. These are the three ugliest months of the year ahead of us, and times when we all feel like we'd like to escape to where you guys are, or even up north to Queensland. But the thing that sustains us is the footy season, so but I don't think with the way West Coast is going, we should be talking about football at the moment, should we?
Well, I think your Cats got done on the weekend, eh?
You've got a good memory.
Yeah. I'll just do the DD on the sport-related stuff, mate. First, before we get into, I guess, company-specific and talking your book and everything, I'm sure Trav wants to get a bit of an insight into, I guess, your and your fund's sort of trading style, and then we'll go into what companies that you're trading.
Yeah, mate, I think what brought up this chat is I saw a LinkedIn post from Lowell sort of advertising the Lassonde curve investment style, and I commented on it from the Money Mine account saying your investment style and our logo have something in common. So I'm very curious, Richard, the Lassonde curve investment style, you're trying to capture the re-rate from a junior as it becomes more developed, and what's the sort of thesis there?
Yeah, look, we've been around for nearly 20 years now. We only turned it into a listed investment trust 5 years ago and put it on the ASX. But we really focus on that early end of the life cycle of a project or a company. And the reason we do that is, we've got a lot of experience in that area. Our chief investment officer, John Forward is, he's been around forever. He's been a banker. He's been a fund manager in the resources space. Done a lot of work in Africa, and so he really has got a good bullshit filter when it comes down to what companies present, what we see on day-to-day basis. So
you'll need a good filter for that early stage, mate. You'd have to make sure that filter's never off.
Exactly, you need it on 24/7, I think,
mate. How often do you have to clean that out? It's a bit like a pool one, like a 6-monthly sort of clean out on the filter, or.
I think it's about every afternoon, I think, as soon as the market closes, really. But look, what we do is we like to get in after that first discovery hole, we've got three things that are important to us, and it's people, and then it's projects, and then it's finance. But number one, it's people. And, if you find that someone makes money for you once over the course of your career, and I've been in this for 35 years, they'll do it for you again. And if you they come back to you and say, hey, listen, what will you do this? And you think, yeah, why not? You guys, you did very well last time and the idea sounds good. So let's go for it. We've got about more than 70 companies in the fund. It's got a market cap NAV of about just over $40 million. We've got about $3 million in cash at the moment. But yeah, we like to get in there nice and early. And this is sometimes the sad part is we have to get out. Once companies hit a certain sort of level, generally when you hit the resource reserve stage, that's it. Then you're hitting that really boring part of the Lassonde curve, which is the financing and the approval stage. And it gets very dull from there. So sadly, that's when we tend to wave goodbye and then try and find the next 5 and 10 baggers. I mean, we really only go into an investment when we see a 10 bagger in front of us. And not all of them come off, but gee, we had a very good run between about 2018 to 2020. We were absolutely blessed there. We had De Grey, we had Liontown. We had quite a few there that really just knocked us. That hit it out of the park for us, and we're ever so grateful there. We had Kidman. We had Syrah was a good one for us, and Centaurus. So yeah, it was a really great time. I think we're not far away. We're on the verge of those sort of days and those sort of performances happening again.
What's the rationale behind your decision to go down the listed investment company route rather than, I guess, your more traditional trust route for the fund?
Well, we had it as a traditional trust for many years. And the problem was is that if you had a very good performance over, say, 6 months or 12 months, were so rude, they wanted their money back. And so...
Oh, bloody nerve off them, mate.
Oh, you'd think it was their money, And that's what happened. So we've taken this thing from, say, $4 million in 2004 to above $40 million with maybe about $2 million of new capital sort of along the way. So it's been a good journey, but the reason why we had to do it is we thought, well, let's put the onus on the investor that if you get your liquidity out of the market rather than forcing us to sell our best performing stocks at the time when we probably didn't feel like selling it, So that was it.
I heard Jeff Wilson of Wilson Asset Management echo a similar sentiment in the rationale for the success of the listed investment structure over there as well. So yeah, that perspective's intriguing.
And it's a lot more protective for the shareholders as well, because you got a bit more money in the bank that you haven't had to distribute, so you can sort of still distribute dividends during those tough times. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, we're actually, because we're a trust, we're obliged to distribute every bit of profit we make. So we've paid, 14 cents, 12 cents so far. We're out of those good years, and we're happy to do it. I mean, we've got a good DRP in place. It ends up being about, we end up paying out about 25%, with the rest being reinvested and coming back for the journey. So you always feel you never want to let that money go, because there's so many magnificent opportunities in the market that you'd like to take up. But hey, it's been a good discipline, actually, that when you're an investor and taking off my fund manager hat and put my investor hat on, I mean, hey, you got to eat, and it's great to get a distribution and it provides an opportunity there for, say, superannuation funds, particularly those in pension mode, to play that end of the market, get that that spread, that diversity inside our portfolio, and also get a return just in case you want to eat.
Mm. Now, with the just before we recorded, Richard, as I'm sure you're well aware, St. Barbara have come out with their no to Silver Lake coming in and doing DD, so essentially confirming that the Genesis deal, unless something else weird happens, which, God, you never bloody know, the Genesis deal looks like it's getting over the line. And I saw your fund, you were a Genesis shareholder but closed that position last month. So you might be able to give a bit of a insight on that whole saga for us, because it is a saga at the moment.
It is a bit, isn't it? Look, the behaviour of the St. Barbara board looks a bit strange from, but I'm 3,000 or 4,000 kilometres away. So what do I know? But my interest in that part of the world is more a little bit further north in Red 5, where seems to be getting its act together a bit better now after stringing together a few good months of production. But the whole second line gold sector, it's just cashed up. It's no wonder these sort of fights and competitions brew and explode, because there's so much cash chasing the opportunity, and you've got a whole lot of producers out there who are making just fantastic money in A-dollar terms out of their gold. And there's companies sitting there with gold in the ground, no one to fund it. And, I think we're in for a big year of M&A in front of us, actually, as those cash levels get deployed and people buy or continue to buy ounces in the ground.
I don't know how many more M&A deals we can handle, because we've spent enough bloody time and resources covering the bloody Genesis, St. Barbara, Silver Lake one. So I don't know. We're going to have to start employing people. So,
I've been to Sons of Gwalia mine a few times, and the history there. I mean, that's a great mine, but it has sent a couple of people broke in their time. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Laylor brothers owning it under Sons of Gwalia, and sent them broke, and it was just a fantastic asset. So I don't know what it is about that hole in the ground, but it certainly isn't an open and shut case. It shows you mining's not that easy, really, in some cases.
Mate, this story, it's all the same characters, just a different time period.
You could do a whole history on bloody between Sons of Gwalia, Leonora, Gwalia, and we've spoken about it, like the history of that and actually documenting it, and the people, the ups and the downs and the booms and the busts, and there's definitely a bloody month worth of podcasts there, I think we might have to tackle.
But oh, definitely, and some characters you'd kick over too. You just walk into the front bar in Leonora there, and you'd get six or seven podcasts out of that in one go.
Richard, I'm very curious. You mentioned being 3,000 to 4,000 kilometres away. Making it challenging to sort of have a view on a board dynamic. But I'm wondering if being that far away also, makes it challenging to have a good view on projects and people at time, especially when a lot of that is in WA, and how do you go about managing that?
There's the purple circle over here, Richard. I'm sure you're well known. I'm trying to get into it.
it's amazing how many companies come over to Melbourne. There is an absolute magnificent pot of money over here, and it's only getting bigger. Especially as these superannuation funds, especially the union run super funds, there's $700 billion sitting there. I mean, people fly from all over the world to come and pitch their idea down here up and down Collins Street. So, yeah, it is, you know, it's like flies to a piece of you-know-what. I mean, it's just dragging investors over here. We get to know them. If you've been around long enough, I mean, I spent, 7 or 8 years going to Diggers every year, and that was a heck of a lot of fun, a big education for me. And it's like us in Melbourne heading over to London or New York or Toronto and catching up with other companies. In fact, one of my roles is I'm the chairman of the Melbourne Mining Club, and basically it's a networking organization. You put enough sort of mining promoters, geologists, mining engineers, and fund managers in a room, and you throw enough beer in there, and I tell you what, it's a powerful mix for getting a mining industry going. And we've been doing it for 150 odd years. Yeah,
sounds pretty similar to the networking functions over here, mate. The beer, that's when all the great relationships get formed, especially after 10 o'clock. I've found. mate, another one that's going to tailor to the M&A theme that's one of your big holdings is Musgrave, because that Murchison area is definitely, there's a lot of potential for consolidation there with these deposits like Musgrave. You've got the mills of Westgold and Gascoyne, and there's a lot of potential, mate. Tell us a bit about your holding.
Kirkalock is there. Gascoyne.
Yeah. I'll take you one step back. Is that one of our key themes over the last couple of years has been to buy stranded gold in the ground, and there's a number of those sort of stocks in our portfolio that's the case, and because we know that these are hungry mills, and a mine is a depleting asset, and the price is being paid, $100, $200 an ounce in the ground. I mean, actually, that's one of the great things I love about your podcast is you get down and dirty with that with those sort of metrics of what drives a deal. And to me, it's always very important about dollars per ounce in the ground. Because I say that to my geo mates, and they all say, "Yeah, but what type of ounces?" And I go, "Oh, come on, you know." But it's whatever you can get through the mill and make a dollar out of. I think. At the end of the day.
And well, I guess what drew you to Musgrave? Like, what was the big ticker there? Because Musgrave, Predictive, one of your bigger ones, and Caravel. But was the Musgrave? It looks okay. It's a very short term opportunity, but it's definitely a very going to be a very successful high grade mine, you'd think.
Oh look, I in our view, it's that people. It's projects and it's finance. People, Robert Waugh, ex-Western Mining, he's very well known over this side of the Nullarbor, and he's a great presenter and a very, very solid custodian of shareholders' money. Tick in that box. His team, tick in that box. We know the area, tick in that box. We know they have that 100% asset, and then right next door they've got the joint venture of the with Evolution, tick in that box. The other thing we've been working on as well for who we invest in that part of the world is new exploration techniques, and especially drilling underneath the salt lakes. How many great projects are we going to find under these areas that are relatively lightly explored, especially with the new techniques of looking through carver and looking through those salt lakes? So tick in that box as well. Finance, yeah, they've got plenty of money to keep themselves going. And as we keep saying on our LinkedIn posts at Lowell, is that with Musgrave, the hits keep on coming. Today even they made another announcement of high grade gold. There's two gold trends. Sitting, I'm not a geologist, but it looks like I think there's going to be multi-million ounces there, and that's why it's our number one holding, and that's why we're there.
I guess what's a good outcome for these situations in this high capital hungry environment where building mills doesn't even make sense anymore, it appears. And I with the whole M&A side of things, there's so many different ways this can play out. What do you consider the ideal situations that Musgrave could find themselves in to get the gold out?
Yeah, look, I'd like them to at least start to build their own and then see what happens. But you're spoiled for choice over there, aren't you, in WA and with so much pressure also on the engineering companies to build new mines. Yeah, that really feeds through also into using up the spare capacity in existing mines. You've even got people from this part of the world, Catalyst, you know, looking to get back into plutonic over there. There really is a big driving force, and certainly building things. It seems like it'd be much better, much simpler. I mean, we all love new mines, don't we? We all love new mills, new projects, because they tend to break down less often. But you know, how long to build them, and then when you build them, when you turn the key in the ignition there, do they flick on? I mean, Red Five's a classic example there of lovely new mill being built, and it took a while to really hit its straps, and the share market hated that. So, there's so many different dynamics in it, Matt.
Yeah, I'm sure before Trav wanted to go, before we get into, I guess, Caravel Predictive and that, we wanted to ask about Victoria Mining, the permitting side of things.
You mentioned Catalyst there. Both of them and Navarre used to, you know, be pretty big on their Victorian gold, and then they've both gone out and acquired gold mines outside of Victoria. So, I'll let you go, Matty.
Yeah, no, sorry, yep. Bloody Trav was about ours. I cut Trav off then. I feel real bad. Sorry.
give us an idea
of the landscape. I think we're looking from over here.
Is it too hard to build a mine there now?
What's the difficulty, I guess?
Yeah, well, look, you're touching on one of my favourite subjects. We've got one of the best gold mines in the world there, Fosterville. It's pinging out 600,000 ounces a year at about, you know, $300 or $400 an ounce. It's making, I did some numbers the other day, back of the envelope, you know, 600, 700 million of EBIT from this, around 20 grams a ton now. At one stage, so they were mining and producing from a, 40 gram a ton ore body. Just a wonderful, wonderful asset. So it's not an orphan. And this is what's driving this. We had an exploration boom here, go back 10 years and we're lucky to spend $5 or $6 million on exploration right across Victoria. And in the most recent year, we hit $200 million, and more than half of that was by Fosterville in mine and around mine. But we're not alone in having a problem with permitting, and it is a bit of a pain. But there's enough companies with enough projects that are permitted now to bring themselves along. We've got a wonderful discovery here by Southern Cross Gold, which is an antimony gold discovery, virtually in one of the northern suburbs of Melbourne, which may not be the best place to find something, but hey, you got to go where the ore body is. And, they've got about five rigs, diamond rigs, sitting on top of this thing now and drilling away and just coming up with these fabulous gold and antimony intersections that is looking very, very much like the Costerville gold mine, gold antimony mine that's for Mandalay. Over here, what we've got three big mines, gold mines, and we've got about another three sort of mines that are just spluttering along. We've got a lot of money being spent in the ground, all seeking that next Fosterville or that next stall or that next Costerfield. The big question is for everyone's mind is, if we find something, what are we going to do then? I mean, it'd be like the dog that catches the car. But one of the driving forces is, if we're sitting here in Victoria and we've got a miserable state budget that hopelessly in debt, and then we look across the Nullarbor at you guys and we see how much royalties are spitting out into the state coffers, and we think, hey, maybe we should be doing more. Maybe there's a good argument, and it's just a matter of sitting down together with farmers and rural communities and explorers and miners and finding a way through here because prosperity, we need it.
Richard, I'm keen to
dive. You guys got it.
Yeah, we are lucky. Good mining jurisdiction in WA. There's no doubt. I'm keen to dive into some of the stocks in your book, and the one that I'm keen to talk about first is actually Caravel. So I really want to understand what the thinking is like internally around sort of weighing up these undeveloped copper alternatives that are on the ASX, and you know, I look at Caravel. And they've got that, you know, pretty chunky kind of pre-production capex of $1.7 billion at the moment, and compare that to Rex Minerals, about half as much, $860 on the latest numbers. So, I guess I'm curious to understand how you guys sort of think about, you know, choosing these options, given there's a bunch of old projects that find themselves have been unloved for a long time, but now the supply dynamics in the copper market are making them super relevant.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Putting my stockbroker hat on here with Ord Minnett, I must field more questions from clients about copper than any other metal at the moment. I mean, they really don't give a toss about gold at the moment, and lithium is a bit on the passe side of things, but it's copper that everyone's thirsting for. And they're all asking the same question. You know, where do we go? A lot of them have cashed in their Oz Minerals money and looking across. I mean, you know, we prefer amongst the producers, there are 29 metals, Owen Hegarty and his crew over there. But in the up and comers, yeah, Caravel is our biggest copper producer. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. A couple of bill, you know, rolls off the tongue. Well, I mean, but. Just think about it. How much are we talking upfront capex? It's a you know, De Grey or Chalice, you know, and these are the sort of meaty projects, or even Winu up north there for Rio. But these sort of chunky bits of capex are the things these big companies love. They love big tons. They love big capex. They love these sort of demanding projects, and then you know, the grade at Caravel is certainly nothing near sexy, but it's a sort of thing where you could see a Rio's come in, or could see a BHP, or maybe even, you know, one of the foreigner, an Anglo or something like that, because it's big, it's not that far away from Perth, and it's probably permittable. that's the other thing. And these guys, you know, I was talking before about the gold companies being chock-a-block with cash. You look at BHP and Rio's and just about everyone in that sector and in that space, they're all just swimming in cash. And you know, right now they're sitting there asking themselves, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to give it back, or am I going to do something with it? And, you know, these things are just so tempting for them, I would think.
I think that they're probably the difference between a comp to De Grey or Chalice is probably that IRR 21%, so any kind of sensitivity to the capex, and you know, you're a bit scared, but at the same time, in a kind of supply dynamic with copper, and you can see just elevated copper prices for a long period of time, then all of a sudden, you know, it's the optionality piece plays a big role, I think, too. So I can see that perspective.
Yeah. Look, I'm not a big believer in IRRs. I've seen enough consultants put those together, and you can almost make it what you want it to be. The big thing to me is there the money around with enough conviction about the commodity in copper that they actually want to get out there and build the next mega mine? Because that's they're not going to build any chiller mines. I mean, if they're going to go out there and build one, it's going to be a big one. And maybe that's where you mentioned Rex before. You know, maybe that's one thing that's holding it back. Yeah, the grades, you know, maybe three times or two or three times more than Caravel at the moment, but maybe there's just not enough tons to interest the big end of town. But yeah, we'll see how that pans out.
Mm.
May as well head over. We're also
you got me started here.
I mean, that's what we're here. No point us talking.
One theme we're looking at very closely at the moment is Canada. I mean, North America, the copper opportunities over there are just, they just make the smaller end here look just like tiddlers. So we really are having a good hard look at opportunities in the North American market. We own rugby thing there. It's in South America, but it hasn't worked out so well. We're having a look at QC Copper. We've again another cheap opportunity over there and listed in the Toronto market, and all our sort of value type markers just keep flashing red at us. This is the place to also have a look. But yeah, we've got a soft spot. I mean, I like owning things in the Australian market, because you can keep an eye on it and go visit the projects. Not like it's at the end of the earth. And you know, the trouble with some of these Canadian things is you don't want to visit them in winter.
No, and I think the ASX or Aussie investors are probably still a bit, I guess, tarnished by the lack of success from everyone that's gone to Canada. So there was that big sort of, you know, a couple of years ago, everyone was thinking, oh, no, let's look at gold in Canada. But, like, look, Pogo took a while to hit its straps. I don't even know you'd say it's hit its straps. Like, you got Red Lake struggling, Silver Lake was struggling over there. Like, everyone that's sort
Atlantic
of gone and had it.
Barbs.
Yeah, and then, of course, Atlantic. And no one's really made Canada work yet, and whether it's gold, copper, it's like, well, technically you'd think gold should be easier than copper, but well, I guess, what's your thoughts on, is everyone going to be sitting on their hands a bit with the whole Canada narrative?
No, I think the you know, it's a bigger capital market than ours. I mean, when it cranks up, when the central bankers around the world decide that they're going to start taking our foot off their foot off our throats and allowing a bit more growth, that's where the money will go first, and it'll come here second. That's the and there's some stuff in sitting there in the US as well, like New World Resources is one of our copper exposures there that we've got high hopes for. So yeah, there's some couple others that we're looking at here. We also hold ANAX. You know, like the look of that. I remember that project from years gone by, and it's certainly a bit of another tempting one that's out there at the moment.
Mm. Back to the Pilbara. I'm keen to get your thoughts on Azure. So it's the 4.6 million tonnes at 1.1% nickel, and the West Pilbara there capped at about 190 million. You look at it, you can see Creasy, Delphi and RCF and yourselves, as instos on the register. So I'm just keen to get your thoughts on what's the thesis on this one.
Oh, look, I hate to be boring and a big, but again, you come back, it comes back to people and projects and finance and people. With Tony Rivera, yeah, really experienced operator. You got Creasy there behind him, maybe with a bullet and moving him on. You've got a nickel resource there to start with, and they've strapped on this opportunity on the top of it in the lithium space. And then you get one of the biggest players in the world coming in there and writing him a check. I mean, it's a lovely thing. I mean, if I had a best, what I dream about is that whole area becoming a bit of a nickel province or a poly base metal province, not unlike what Chalice has got. I don't think it'll be as good as that, but you're talking a very, very lightly explored part of the world, and some great explorationists sitting on top of it and going for it. And gee, that's a very powerful mix in these day and age, especially with these new exploration techniques they're getting into more and more. I mean, it's they don't lead with a drill bit as much anymore. They they go. They're very, very closely targeted before they stick a drill hole in. So now that really, really excites me.
Now we're learning that there's more than just iron ore in the Pilbara from De Grey. So
yeah. I'm sure there's plenty of exploration drillers covered in mud and shit every day that want some better technology to come out to find the stuff a bit easier. But, I don't think there's any... Yeah, I'm glad they're doing it and I'm not, put it that way. So, mate, do you want to head to Africa? Well, we're both head over to Africa for PDI Predictive. We did chat with the Precision Funds lads the other day about them. They're also a fan. And Trav's pointed out that they're in the trough of the old infamous Lassonde curve. But you guys are... I was going to say balls deep. I better not say that, but you're in deep with them.
we're even ballsier deep there before. We first got in this one in the float, would you believe?
Oh, yeah.
Way back in about 2010, I think it was, before I even got to the Lowell Fund. And, you know, it's again, sorry to be boring, but you're backing the people. And Paul Roberts, he was such a persuasive and excitable and you know, every dollar that you could possibly go into the ground, went into the ground under his leadership there. And I'm sure that's the case as well. And then we've even followed Paul over into his next venture at the moment, because, you know, again, want to back people who have made us money. I mean, actually, I've got a confession to make. About 4 years ago, you know, we were looking at how to trim the few of the, you know, losers out of the portfolio, and we had a good look at Predictive, and there was a choice of either taking up a placement, I think it was at half a cent, would you believe, or tossing the whole lot out. And we said, oh, come on, roll the dice, come on, back the man. And we don't hold nearly as many as we did at our peak, again, because you get to that part of the Lassonde curve and you think, yeah, God, I hate to do it. And these guys, you know, you get to know them over 4 or 5 years and you become quite friendly with them. And it's very hard sometimes to say, no, it's hit our exit time. We've got to get out. And sometimes we don't. I mean, Gold Road's a really great example as well. We were there in Gold Road well when they were just a penny stock. And then we held it and we just didn't get out when it first peaked. I think it peaked in the sort of less than a dollar, but it went from, you know, pennies up to close to that, fell all the way back down to pennies again, where we bought a few more. And then, I think we sold the last of our Gold Road at about, about a year ago at maybe about $1.50. Sad to see the last one go out the door. It was, likewise, we had to sell the last of our De Grey only earlier this year. And, it's a sad moment. But, we put it up there on LinkedIn and we said, thank the company managers, on behalf of our unit holders for the great run they've given us. But I think, you know, over my time in as both a broker and a fund manager, the things where you lose money is when you break your rules. So yeah, we've got to stick to our rules, stick to our mandate, stay true to it, and we've built something from 4 mil to 40 mil. So I mean, it's we'd like to get a lot bigger.
Yeah, well, you're obviously doing something right then. I think that De Grey Gold Road whole, relationship, and throw Goldfields in there with their JV interested at bloody Gruyere. It's definitely, how do you see all that playing out with De Grey? Big refractory ore body, bit of capital to get it going. There's a bit to happen there, I think. Well, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I was in De Grey PA, I think, in the float, and a bit of a soft spot for that company for a long, long time. And then it didn't hear about it for about 15 years. And then the Lowell Fund picked up a nice holding at sort of pennies. I don't have any special knowledge on this one, but just sitting back there from the grandstand in Melbourne and looking at it, I think Gold Road have played an absolutely magnificent game. They've got this fantastic cash flow out of Gruyere that, you know, they've got to put to good use. And they bought a blocking stake or a you know, put a toe in the water. For they'll be the ones who decide who is the developer of De Grey. And again, it gets back to that big project. You're going to be moving lots of Western Australia to get to that gold. You're going to be processing a lot. It's got big company project written all over it. And Gold Road are going to be the ones to determine who gets it. I wouldn't even rule out De Grey trying to force the issue by doing it themselves, and maybe doing something either in joint venture because they've certainly got the cash flow to service the sort of $1 billion or $2 billion of debt that they'll need to get a project up there. So I think they're brilliantly positioned now. Now, whether Gold Road shareholders at $1.70 or whatever we are today get to see any benefit about that is a different question. I mean, that's all, you know, commodity prices being what they are. But, you know, it might be a bit scary. But I think that, you know, gee, they played a beautiful hand so far with that first takeover they made. And I think they're in a pretty good position to sort out who gets the right to build this thing, because, you know, maybe you got 10 million ounces sitting there in the ground at De Grey and someone's going to build it.
And I think there's still a lot of M&A to play out on the bigger end of town, because you've obviously the big one at the moment's Newmont and Newcrest, but then, God, you've got Goldfields and Anglo Gold, Ashanti, what was the news the other week? They did some... joined some rights in Africa, and, you know, Goldfields are on the hunt for some ounces. I can't see Newmont and Newcrest being the last of some big consolidation at that top end of town. And, like, you know, this De Grey project is something that falls into the hands of one of those big consolidated companies if they do form. Plenty to play out, I think.
Oh, it definitely is. And isn't it amazing how Australia has gone from, you know, being a over-regulated, you know, high labour cost place where you wouldn't want to do mining business, to now being, yeah, we love it. It's a tier one jurisdiction. West Australia's number two, I think it is a place to do mining business. Isn't it amazing how it's changed? And you've got those that Magic De Grey asset and the Chalice asset there just sitting there saying, come on, guys, develop.
Come on, build me, hurry up.
Yeah.
And I guess...
I guess the only thing that's what would worry people is the workforce. You know, the people there to build it up. I would, you know, help me out here. I would have thought they'd... There's plenty of talent and bodies in your part of the world that to build these things. I mean, they can't all have either got COVID and died off or left the industry to count their ill-gotten gains.
Yeah, well, there was that period probably, 2 years ago, when everything started really, you know, coming back online and new mines started. And, like, look, we've seen a lot of the new mines start that have struggled, and the ramp ups, or, you know, between Red 5, Calidus and Pantoro and all those ones that haven't had such a good journey. It's like a lot of people have referred to it as a bit of a profitless boom, because there was that between COVID and then the labor shortages with all this new mines coming online, the wages that were required to retain people, and people are moving around for an extra bloody 50 grand a year left, right, and centre. And I just think the industry's still recovering from that a bit. But I have been, you know, speaking to some mining contractors that have got to the point now that they're over-manned as well. Got to be careful in this bloody current world, saying the old sayings like over-manned. But they're at the point now where they're starting to bring the wages back a little bit, because the rates they had to pay to keep people just weren't sustainable long term, and didn't really reflect what an individual can output So I feel there's a bit of a changing of the tide about to happen. Not happened yet.
It's interesting, isn't it? We had Stuart Tonkin from Northern Star speak at the Melbourne Mining Club late last year, and you know, afterwards I said to him, you know, we've got the about the churn rate over here in the mining industry, up, you know, up and down the East Coast, about 30%. What's it like over there? And he said, yeah, about the same. So it's similar, isn't it? I would have thought it'd be, you know, people here would have been more sticky, but look, when those commodity prices are high, when the Aussie dollar is so low and the margin's so good, you will swallow your pride and pay a bit more for the right person or the right people, the right team.
But I think, and it's the speed at which the transitions happen, and I think that's the issue, because there was such a quick ramp up of everything and all this work that come online, and people, there was the supply shortage of labour, the wages went up. Now it's sort of calming down a bit, so it'll, you know, reach a bit of an equilibrium where companies have actually got sufficient manning. Like, you can just tell by the amount of recruitment posts online, they've just sort of gone away. But then it only takes, like you've got the Liontown contract coming up, which is going to be one of the biggest underground mining contracts in Australia, and then it only takes, you know, a couple of these big projects like De Grey and things like that to start coming online, and usually everything starts coming in a flurry because the market tells all the big money that it's the safe time to start investing, and then we're back in the same position. There's just never any smooth transition period between shortages and excess of labour and costs. If you've got a crystal ball to get a leg up on all of that stuff, that'll be very valuable to the fund, I reckon.
Well, you know, and it's, truth be told, it's always been like this, and that makes it half the fun, doesn't it? You know, the ups and downs and the opportunities that present themselves, and you know, getting back to the St Barbara situation, you know, that's had its ups and downs. I remember last time, it had a hard time. You know, you couldn't give the stock away at about 7 cents, and I think it went up to about, you know, $3 a share, and not a lot of change except a couple of new faces around the operating table.
So with the copper, Richard, you've obviously got a pretty good copper thesis behind your fund's investment strategy at the moment. What do you see is going to be the big catalyst for this copper price rise that everyone's waiting for, but we haven't seen it yet?
That's it.
Get that crystal ball out again for me, mate.
I'll just pedal a bit faster on that one. Oh, it's interesting. I mean, I had the good fortune to go to a big international mining conference in Saudi Arabia, would you believe, in Riyadh back in January. I was sitting there, and one of the things that dragged me over there was that we're going to see the speech from Mike Henry, the CEO of BHP. Yeah, well, you maybe get some insight on this. And look, he and other speakers, to a man and a woman, were saying the same thing. Is that the it was almost crying, as in we have not got the fiscal capacity to meet what our forecasters are telling us is going to be the copper demand going forward, and no one has. And that was way back in January, and since February, March, April, May. We're here, and the copper price has done nothing but go down from about, you know, $4.50 down to, you know, $3.70 a pound. You know, it's and not only him. I mean, the global MD of Trafigura stood up there. He's an Aussie guy, by the way. He stood up and said the same thing. He said, we cannot get our hands on any copper. But look, something must be happening, because you know, you would have think the law, you know, supply and demand 101 tells you that if there's heaps of demand and no supply, I mean, price got to go up, and it certainly hasn't. So, yeah, well, we're scratching our heads. I'm sure it's going to happen, but because everyone's telling me the same thing, from all the way from the metal traders, you know, through to the company executives and boards of directors are all saying the same thing. So we need copper, and And it's, yeah, it's just not happening.
Well, we had Mr. William James Beament on the other week to talk about, you know, what they're up to at Woodlawn. So I guess they're what develops doing in contrast to, so you look at, I guess, your Caravels and your Wrecks and all that, like they've got the deposits there, but they need the big capital, they need the kickstart to get it going. Whereas, look, I guess developer going down the road with their Woodlawn asset, trying to prove up some more mineralisation there. You've got then, which Bill's involved in as well, as the Metals Acquisition Corp looking to get a bit more out of Cobar. And then, look, you've got that whole new, heading over to your side of the country, like that New South Wales region in and around Cobar, like with Peel and then CSA. And so there seems to be a lot of copper plays potential that would, you know, yield a bit of organic growth within some existing assets that I see that might come to the forefront for, and God, if you look at companies that are going to have the money backing and the, I guess, the underground mining expertise to make it happen, develops sort of sitting at that top of the list where you'd think companies that are going to start making a play for these.
But do you think it'd be a bigger, an easier decision for a company with the cash in its balance sheet, like a BHP, or to pick one, that it'd be an easier decision from them? And Bill, he can't sort of point his head to the sky and ask for money to rain on him, and it doesn't happen like that. I mean, and banks are not your friend anymore when it comes to project financing. Private equity is probably the easiest source of streaming or royalties are probably the easiest source of capital to kickstart these things. I mean, banks are they're sort of absent from the party, and there at the end of the day, the equity market is not the easiest, but probably the quickest way of getting cash in to start up a project or want a substance anyway.
Do you think, well, I guess because BHP have always had that thesis of everything has to be that BHP class of an ore body, like it has to be, they even said Olympic Dam didn't really fit their mould because it wasn't making the massive amount of cash that BHP is used to making. Do you think with, the shortage of these really high quality copper projects and even base metals in general, that they might start looking at things that aren't jumping off the page as a big greenfields BHP project, but think, right, we're going to have to actually start investing in these greenfields projects that to get this secure this copper supply that we're going to need?
Yeah, I think you're definitely going to see that. And again, that's one of our investment thesis, stranded assets in the ground. It was only in the last few years I understand that the bigger companies like BHP have really restocked their business development departments. They got rid of them at about 2014, and now they're prepared to rebuild them again and to go out and do the project assessment. But I would have thought at the moment though that it's still that sort of analysis paralysis going on inside a lot of big mining houses. Because they copped a fearful beating from the institutional investors and brokers as well during the over the last decade from the overinvestment in the first decade of this century. Beltings they've taken. You don't forget them too quickly and they are reticent, having said that, I think once one really hits the go button, the others are going to follow not far behind. And, the sort of deal sizes like BHP taking Oz and Newmont taking Newcrest, just to name two, and they're big deals, there's got to be more just happening, this tech, Glencore going for tech, I mean, the more fascinating stuff for us probably is what's going to drop off the back when they when they rationalize the portfolio they've bought and who's going to get it. Because that's where great companies are made, isn't it? Look at Bill Beament, he made his money, made a fortune out of, and for his shareholders, out of the, what dropped off the back of those Americans charging in and buying the big gold assets in WA. I mean, it's fascinating to see what will drop off the back of these things and who's going to be the company makers. It's not going to be old farts like me who are playing in that end, but I'll definitely be young blokes. I mean, that's going to be one of the fascinating things to see who out there in their 30s and 40s, has come up through the ranks and wants to have a really big swing, because there's going to be a great opportunity coming up over the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, and like, God, you look what Northern Star did with all the Barrick and Newmont assets, and now Newmont are coming back into Australia in a way by taking Newcrest. It's those sort of cutting around the fringes of the ore bodies that weren't good for the big dogs definitely yield a lot of profits for the smaller companies without the corporate overheads. So, mate, what a bloody great time to be in mining, I reckon. Is there a bad time?
Oh yes, there were some bad times. Yeah. Oh dear, don't. But thankfully, I've forgotten that. I've got a bit of amnesia about those bad times. I remember copper at sub a dollar and zinc at about 40 cents and stuff like that. And, you're just tearing your hair out. I haven't got any hair left, actually.
I guess were some of the most difficult times to be in the fund world within the mining sector? Can you pinpoint a few in the past?
Oh, yeah, the early 1980s, before the gold boom in 85, just had that big run-up in the gold price and it just crashed. The absolute backside fell out of the mining industry. But that provided opportunities for BHP, picking up Utah. And then we had a big boom in the late 80s, and then the most horrible times in from about 89 through to about 94, and then suddenly it took off again. And that's a wonderful thing. Slowed down again during the .com. I mean, we started the Melbourne Mining Club in 2001, and the reason we did it is because I was a finance journo in my background, and all the finance journos over in this part of the world. We look at each other and go, can't even get a 3 or 4 column inches in the Fin Review or somewhere. What are we used to get? Have these big splashes, the Mining and Energy Review. I went for 5-10 pages, had everything. The public were thirsty for news. I don't think that appetite ever went away to know more about mining. So what we did to start the Melbourne Mining Club is we said, all right, what we'll do is we'll have a lunch, we'll invite a few of our mates, and we'll see if we can get one of the CEOs. And, we're luckily, guys like Avi Pabo and Hugh Morgan would, love to come down and talk to us and talk and share their thoughts about the future with us. And suddenly, from having 100 people at a lunch, we get 400 or 500, the big mining company CEOs from around the world come in and just to put their case forward. And it's certainly something that we need to do, is we need to get out there and swing. It's interesting, on LinkedIn, I started up this thing called the Victorian Mining Industry Forum, because we could not get even a few lines in the paper. It was even hard to get into the really great mining newsletters like Mining News and Mining.com, because they're just, Victoria was seen as a bit of a laughing stock. But we've got more than 40 listed companies here exploring and producing in Victoria. So there's always a lot happening, and but no coverage. So I said, bugger it, I'll do it myself. So pop their ASX announcements up on LinkedIn, it's a great place for the industry to think, we have got a pulse. Not a fast pulse, but it's a pulse,
Well, mate, I guess times have changed in the media world with, your main newspapers that everyone you know, has become accustomed to, but just within the recent couple of months, we're the new, I guess, top dogs in town of mining media, mate. So if you need anything released, you bring it to us first. I think we're the go-to spot now on Money of Mine. So we'll just kick those other ones to the side, I reckon. So,
I think so. Podcasts are just such a great thing. I mean, a friend of mine, he likes to listen to it at 2x speed. I mean, everyone sounds a bit like Mickey Mouse when they talk, but you get through them a lot faster.
Oh, I can't. I don't have the brain power to take that much information in quickly. Jonas, JD, the other guy, he listens on 1.5, but they him and Trav consume information a lot quicker than me. I'm still got the underground mining. Probably had too much fun in mining and at uni, mate. The brain slowed down a bit as I got older. So, and I got a mate. I'm only bloody 36, so God help me. Mate,
I've got you by a few years.
Mate, sensational chat, mate. I could bloody talk mining and stocks for ages, so, and I'm sure but you have a life to get back to. So, mate, really appreciate you reaching out to us and coming on. That was some great insight on, I guess, the stocks you've held, but just the broader thoughts on, you know, M&A and copper and everything, which is what we're all keen to know more about. So I reckon the listeners got a lot out of hearing your wisdom, Richard.
Oh, thanks, Matt, and give my best to Trav. It was I love your show. It's you really get down to the things that are important in mining, and without forgetting the mateship and the camaraderie that we so love in the industry. So fantastic work, Matty. Sounds fantastic.
Oh, I think we had to put a mining podcast media service out that highlighted that every mining stock doesn't go up. Because a lot of the other ones out there are getting paid, so we're probably going against the grain a bit, but it's definitely going well. So we look forward to having you on many times in the future, Richard. Really appreciate it.
Oh, that'd be lovely, mate. Get over here. We've got a great mining conference in Melbourne, Mines and Money Connect. We've got iMark in Sydney.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, we get 7,000 people. It's interesting, that one. I mean, you know, we talk about diggers and dealers. You're struggling to get 2,500 people there, but it's really emerging, and we're hoping it might get as big as something like a PDAC in this world, or people like to learn about mining.
Yeah, well, the clause in the contract with JD and Trav is that I am the one responsible for all the BD, which means that I'll be attending all the mining conferences and drinking piss with all the fundies. So that's my cup of tea, that side of things, mate. They can stay here and do all the editing. So,
well, can I book you in for a cold one next time you're in our part of the world, mate?
Most definitely, mate. Won't have to twist my arm. And too easy, mate. Really appreciate it. And look, best of luck with the investments, mate. Hopefully luck doesn't come into it, but tell you what, it's handy when it does.
It's very handy, isn't it? Yep. I hear you.
Good on you, mate. We'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, buddy. Cheers, then.
All right, Matty, what did you think of that?
Good. I like talking. As I said, I'd hit the stop button at the end. I could just talk bloody mining, copper and all that sort of stuff and chew the fat forever. So I hope the money miners like that.
But I definitely reckon the questions got better after.
happy to be of service, mate. Now let's go over a bit of a recap of what's out there today, because we can't leave the money miners without a bit of a round the grounds, can we, Trav? Now,
but it'd be a real shame.
We're getting it now. We're going to look at. We've even got a bit on commodities today. Copper down 8.5% this month, and which is goes against our chat that we had with Richard and everyone else predicting this copper supply shortage. But it still keeps going down 12.8% since the start of April. So it's sitting at $3.55 a pound. So it was up near $4 at the end of last year. So
yeah, I think the way I interpret that one is, like, you know, the copper market in the short term is, you know, so sensitive to changes in demand. I think in the long term, the supply story will really shine through with copper. So, and it's a pretty compelling supply thesis there.
And we did see with the strategic update of 29 metals, and coupled with this drop in copper price, they've had a lot of share price pressure down 20% yesterday, and down a further 11 today. So the copper price is really impacting them as well. So Predictive Discovery, PDI, who we did talk about with Richard, so they're raising money today. Apparently it's $40 million bucks at 15 cents a share. So that's a 6.25% discount. So this comes 3 days after the company identified some new drill targets at its Bankan project. So Urals Hartleys and SCP Resources are on the ticket for this raise. So they're over in Africa, in Guinea.
One of Lau's holdings, that one?
One of Lau's holdings.
Wonder if they're tipping in.
Lowell. Pronounce it right, Trav. Oh, I've got to watch you, mate. Aeris Resources, AIS. So they've come out with some good intercepts at its Bentley mine. So that's part of the Jaguar operations over in Western Australia. So that includes 10 metres at 1.44% copper and 18% zinc. So they're going to roll that through to an updated mineral resource and life of mine plan. Now, you've also got Sandfire Resources. They've produced their first concentrate at the Mateo mine in Botswana. God, I've pronounced that wrong. JD.
I think you have, mate.
I think it's Mateo. You'd think Mothio, but it's Mateo. So I was a...
Who thinks Mothio? That's it, mate.
Aussie people like me that read it as it's spelt. Eyes are now on the grant of the mining lease for the A4 pit and commencement of mining activities there. So the company is also expanding the mill from a 3 million tonne nameplate up to a 5.2 million tonne per annum, and that's aimed by early 24. So Sandfire obviously very and only leveraged mostly to the copper price. So they'd be hurting a bit with this rise, with this depreciation in it, but very exposed to it when it does go up.
Oh, yeah. Growing throughput there, expecting the supply thesis to sort of shine through when they're producing even more tonnes, mate.
I'm sure they're looking for that repeat of DeGrussa somewhere.
Wouldn't yeah, and I'm waiting for an update on Khoemacau, which is obviously the other big copper project up for grabs, not too far away in Botswana there, which you'd think they'd be pretty interested in too.
And you look at that in their annual output now compared to DeGrussa, which DeGrussa was a 1.6 million tonne per annum mine, and that put out about, I think it was from memory, 65,000 tonnes of copper per year from a 1.6 million tonne plant.
Great.
With only a couple of jumbos and 5 or 6 trucks or something. So just I hear even
average
king.
Jumbo operators there, mate, could get the job done.
No, I was in the office there, mate.
So. Oh, yeah. Sorry, the jumbo operators are actually doing work.
That's probably why it was a success. Right, mate. Thank you, Trav.
Hooteroo.
Short, quick and nasty.
Beautiful, mate.
Love it. Cheers, money miners. Hooteroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.